Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Huckenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. This hour, examining an old colonial-era rule in Maryland's courthouses that now means hundreds of prisoners are getting new trials. And with turmoil in Israel, Syria, and now Iraq, a look at the recent moves by Vladimir Putin in Russia and why chaos around the globe could be working in his favor. But we begin outside St. Louis, Missouri today, where the shooting of an 18-year-old African-American man has sparked protests and anger among the community there. On Saturday, Michael Brown, who was unarmed, was shot and killed by a police officer in Ferguson, that's a middle-class suburb of St. Louis. Details are still unclear, but here's St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar at a news conference over the weekend.
It is our understanding at this point in the investigation that within the police car there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
Local news channel KSDK spoke with Michael Brown's mother, Leslie McSpadden, who said her son did not deserve to die.
You're not God. You don't decide when you're going to take somebody from her. If that was the case, I brought him here. I should have took him from her. That was mine. That belonged to me.
The officer in question has been put on paid administrative leave, and we've learned today that the FBI will be taking over this investigation from local officials. Earlier today, I spoke with John Gaskin, who serves on the National Board of Directors for the NAACP in St. Louis County.
Let's just say this. Whatever happened, there was a young man that was killed. This kind of police brutality has to stop, and it has to stop right away. You know, being a 21-year-old young man, being a BMW, as we see at the NAACP, a black man walking, I realize those risks, that you have to walk a little more carefully, and you have to be so very careful because, believe it or not, there are officers that won't necessarily respond in the most proper manner.
Rachel Lippman is a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. She joined us earlier to talk about the state of protests in Ferguson and what transpired over the weekend.
Todd, the protests started off like many of the others that had happened over the weekend. And while the protests had been boisterous, they'd been loud, they had not turned violent. That changed last night, Sunday night, when a group of protesters after a march began throwing bottles and cans and eventually rocks at police officers. And when the police dropped back for their safety, that's when looting began. And that became fairly widespread throughout about a 5 to 10 mile patch of North St. Louis County.
How long did those riots go on?
We were still getting reports from the St. Louis County Police Department early this morning of very sporadic looting or individuals, to young teenagers, casing stores, looking like they might want to break in. But it lasted from probably about 9 o'clock until the very, very early hours, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning on Monday.
Well, we heard the statement just a moment or two ago from the St. Louis County Police Chief saying there was a struggle for the officer's weapon, implying that's how the shooting took place. What are residents there looking for now?
They want answers. Whether they will ever accept the story that the St. Louis County Police Department is saying happened, I don't know. They want to know how and why it was that an unarmed teenager, who everyone, by all accounts, who I've heard say was just a gentle giant, would never have wanted to be in any kind of struggle, how he ended up dead. There's also just a general sense of frustration with how the African-American community is often treated in Ferguson. And that may have just been the boiling point last night, was when this teenager is killed and people just vent their frustration on the community.
Well, Rachel, what appears to be the next step in the police investigation?
The St. Louis County Police Department is the one handling the investigation as an outside agency. They'll be reviewing the crime scene. They'll be reviewing statements from witnesses. They've already spoken extensively to the Ferguson police officer involved in this incident. They did say yesterday that he had not had any other instances of violence or issues in his 6 years on the Ferguson police force. Then they'll turn that file over to the county prosecutor, who would review it for any kind of criminal charges. The Reverend Al Sharpton is supposed to be in the St. Louis area today. There is expected to be a rally at the police department, the Ferguson Police Department today. Although the parents of Michael Brown had basically said, if these rallies are going to turn into looting, we don't want any part of it. We're not sanctioning any additional protests. The local branch of the NAACP is also holding an event tonight to discuss how it is that they can start healing the community.
Rachel Littman, can you describe the town of Ferguson a little bit? Who lives there? How many people?
It is a town that is about 60% black, 30% white. It is out near our airport. So it's a mixture of industrial and commercial areas. There's a Walmart, a Sam's Club. It's nestled in between two highways. It's kind of an inner ring suburb of St. Louis City. And I saw it mentioned from some of the leaders in St. Louis City yesterday that this is just kind of urban problems continuing to spread as the jobs continue to spread farther and farther from the urban core.
Well, certainly some people are starting to view this case in a broader context. Rachel Littman, Michael Brown's parents have retained the lawyer that represented Trayvon Martin's parents in Florida.
Yes, they did. And when I was at the beginning of the rally last night, the peaceful part of the rally, there were several shirts referencing Trayvon Martin, referencing what had happened down there. It's important to remember that unlike in Trayvon Martin's case, this was an officer of the law who shot and killed Michael Brown after allegedly a struggle. This was not a civilian. There's no stand your ground context here. But certainly it is very much a white on black or racial tension crime.
And we'll see if the nuances of the case or the differences in the law end up making a difference in the reaction and the rage that a lot of people in Ferguson are feeling. Rachel Littman, reporter for St. Louis Public Radio, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
We go now to Iraq, where political strife threatens to push the country even further into the hands of the radical militant group ISIS. Iraq's embattled Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said he would not step down in Baghdad despite calls for his resignation. Meanwhile, several days of U.S. airstrikes have helped Kurdish forces retake some territory from ISIS. Senior U.S. officials have confirmed that American forces are providing weapons to Kurdish forces, helping that group to defend Erbil, the capital of the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Well, just yesterday, in an op-ed in The Washington Post, Masoud Barzani, the president of the Kurdish region of Iraq, pleaded for U.S. help. He wrote, "We are the United States' staunch allies in the region, and we have the only force in the area with the means and the will to protect thousands of lives from the horrors that these terrorists bring. But we cannot do it alone." And listen here to John McCain on CNN just yesterday.
"I would be rushing equipment to Erbil. I would be launching airstrikes not only in Iraq but in Syria against ISIS. I would be providing as much training and equipment as I can to the Kurds. And I would do a lot of things that we can not have to wait for Maliki to leave."
Well, retired Colonel Harry Shute is now an advisor to the Kurdistan regional government. He commanded a U.S. civil affairs battalion in Iraq in 2003 and led the U.S. Army Command in Kurdistan during the early phases of the war. Welcome, Colonel Shute.
Thank you.
Colonel, there's been limited bombing, of course, on the outskirts of Erbil and also near Mount Sinjar. We've read about that. We've also read that this has emboldened the Peshmerga, the Kurdish security forces. Can you describe how they're emboldened and what that means?
The airstrikes that the U.S. government has performed have provided a huge morale boost to the Kurdish Peshmerga. Not only the Peshmerga, but the people in Kurdistan. There's almost a huge sigh of relief that the support has started to come.
I just read part of an impassioned plea from the president of the Kurdish region there. He's asking for U.S. support. He's asking for U.S. heavy weapons, not just moral support, but making the point that the Peshmerga need to be able to match ISIS forces and push them back. What would heavier weapons mean? What can the U.S. do militarily there?
Well, heavy weapons literally can mean anything from large caliber machine guns, rockets, to anti-tank weapons, to armored vehicles, literally everything. And the reason for that is because the Peshmerga, the Kurdish forces, are simply armed with weapons that they captured from Saddam Hussein from 2003 and earlier. So everything they have is very old, it's obsolete, poor condition. Whereas ISIS is armed with equipment that they took from the Iraqi army when they collapsed 2 months ago, which is mostly equipment that was provided to them by the U.S. government.
Now, is it as simple, however, Colonel Shute, of just giving the Kurds lots of heavy weapons? I mean, there is a political ecosystem in Iraq that is extremely complicated, more complicated even than before in the last couple of days in Baghdad. Would the Baghdad central government stand for a heavily armed Kurdish region? For that matter, would Turkey stand for it? Can we just airdrop lots of heavy weapons, artillery, tanks, and give it to the Kurds?
Well, certainly it is a complex mix. In fact, one of the reasons why the Peshmerga have not been armed until now is because of obstruction in Baghdad. But of course, as you mentioned, we are in the middle of a very dynamic and changing scenario in Baghdad as we speak. But the reality is that the Peshmerga are the one viable force who is standing up in Iraq to fight against ISIS. And we know who they are. They have been very loyal, very supportive of us. I mean, I can say as a commander who was here commanding troops in 2003, 2004, the fact that I was able to bring every one of my soldiers out of Iraq unharmed is a testament to the capabilities of the Peshmerga. There are not many places in the country where my colleagues can say the same thing.
You know, Colonel Shute, a lot of Americans look at the situation there. I mean, we all understand why there aren't going to be U.S. troops back on the ground in Iraq after 12 or 13 years of war there. That makes sense. Why aren't there 100 American Predator drones in the skies in and around Kurdistan over the skies there launching attacks on ISIS forces wherever they see them?
Well, that's a very good question. Perhaps somebody in Washington may know the answer to that. I know our friends here in Kurdistan would welcome that. They have the facilities to support it. And believe me that those predators would have plenty of work to do.
I want to move on to the humanitarian situation for a moment. There were, of course, thousands, tens of thousands of Yazidi people stranded on Mount Sinjar. Some have escaped into Syria. Many thousands more remain on the mountain. Also many refugees in your region there in Erbil. Can you give a sense of the humanitarian situation, the refugee situation, as people flee ISIS there?
Well, that's a very desperate situation as well. Just in the Kurdistan region alone, there are 1.2 million refugees and displaced people. Some of the people that have come down off of Mount Sinjar have been able to make it with Peshmerga assistance up into the city of Duhok. And as you mentioned, some have gone into Syria. But we're in a situation here where the Baghdad government has withheld the budget from the Kurdistan regional government since the beginning of the year. So it's challenging enough for the Kurdistan regional government to pay for their own activities, let alone support a population of 1.2 million additional people who are in a desperate situation with no shelter, limited food. It's a great challenge and something that I think the international community really needs to step up to soon.
Harry Shute's a retired U.S. colonel and an advisor now to the Kurdistan regional government. He led a U.S. Army command in Kurdistan during the early phases of the war there in 2003. Colonel, thank you.
You're welcome.
We all know the phrase beyond a reasonable doubt. You've seen it in television, courtroom dramas. You've probably heard it in jury duty yourself, maybe. It's the legal standard for a jury to convict somebody of a crime. It's the law, and we all know it. Well, what if a judge turned to a jury, turned to you as a juror, and said, hey, I know I'm the judge, but take what I say, you know, purely advisory. Do what you think is best. Don't worry about this whole beyond a reasonable doubt thing. You can interpret the law yourself. It's really up to you. Now, that sounds pretty crazy, but that's exactly what happened in Maryland for years, where outdated wording from colonial times was still hanging around in Maryland courthouses. It wasn't until 2012 that Maryland's Court of Appeals decided that some people sentenced to life in prison by these juries deserved another trial. And so now 250 prisoners are requesting new trials. And as you might have guessed, it sparked a big debate in Maryland about whether unearthing these cases is a good idea for the prisoners and for the families of the victims. University of Maryland Law Professor Michael Milliman represents dozens of these defendants, and he says it's arcane jury instructions that have caused all the problems.
Many of the judges back in the day in the 60s and 70s gave a reasonable doubt instruction, but they made it advisory. And they said to the jury, you're not bound by my instructions. And that's the nub of the problem. You're right, it dates to colonial times. In colonial times, revolutionary leaders were trying to figure out ways to nullify English law that was being applied by English Tory judges. And so they came up with this approach. And then when we adopted our constitution and the states began to develop their own constitutions, they put this provision in the earliest constitutions.
Where judges were telling juries, okay, it's just advisory, interpreting the law really in the end is up to you, you free citizens. Well, so as I understand it, courts in Maryland overturned this back in 1980. They said, okay, we're not going to do that anymore.
That's right.
But that was only prospectively. So it was only in 2012 that they decided, wait a second, all those people from 1980 or even before up to 2012 might need new trials.
That's exactly right. And the people who were entitled to new trials were the people who were tried in 1960 and 1970. So you've got people who average age is 64. They've been locked up. The mean is between 36 and 40 years. And at least the 67 who are now out compiled very impressive prison records, got GEDs in prison, got bachelor degrees in prison, a couple got master's degrees, engaged in programming, and were good citizens. So, as they come out as many of them as senior citizens with a radically different world than it was in 1960s and 70s.
I was just about to say, what has it been like for a lot of those people who've been incarcerated for 35 and 40, sometimes longer, years, to come out into a world with the internet and smartphones and everything else? I mean, things have changed so very much.
Yeah, I'll give you one example. I picked up one of the prisoners who I argued on behalf of down on the Eastern Shore, and I gave him a ride back to his program in Baltimore. I have a 2003 Volvo that has bare bones, nothing in it. He got in the car and said, wow, this is a spaceship. And I tried to explain to him that he's going to see a lot more cars that he would consider spaceships. So it's been a transition. Now, the good news is that we have 15 or so social workers. The Public Defender's Office, which has really been the leader on this project, has its own social workers. And we're developing safety nets for everybody who's coming out. Housing, access to medical care, access to benefits, even the simple things, how you get a bus pass, how you get a Social Security card. So they're coming out with support. But, the point I would make, prison life is structured minute by minute to take away your ability to make decisions. You're told what to do every second of the day. So it is a huge adjustment. It's not just the 3 or 4 decades later factor. It's the fact that prison is structured to take away autonomy.
To reintegrate somebody who's been institutionalized by design back into society, regardless of whatever whiz bang technologies we have. Well, Professor Milliman, what about the rest of the people? You mentioned 67 who've come out. There are hundreds more demanding retrials. Are the ranks of prisoners getting released and maybe entering your program and trying to reintegrate going to just grow and grow? Or might some of them be retried and reconvicted? What's going to happen?
Actually, state's attorneys, including in Baltimore City, where most of these negotiations have come from, and particularly outside Baltimore City, are retrying a number of them, or they're appealing decisions to the Court of Special Appeals. So I think it's a mixed bag. There are another, whatever the difference is between 67 and 250, that's the number of other inmates who have claims under this decision. And as I said, a number of state's attorneys are negotiating releases because, frankly, it's in the state's interest to do so. The average cost of a prisoner in Maryland is about $38,000 a year. I don't think that includes capital costs. These folks, because of their age and their medical needs, are substantially more expensive. So, when you need an operation, you need surgery, you need constant medical attention, it's going to add up. These guys come out on probation. They have conditions of probation they must follow. They don't attack the guilty verdict. That's part of the agreement. It's just a resentencing. So the state gets a lot of supervision and structure on these guys, and they, in turn, get to come out of prison.
Old jury instructions dating back to the era of King George are still haunting the courts in the state of Maryland. And ever since 2012, there are hundreds of prisoners, 250, getting new trials. About 70 of them have already come out of prison. Michael Milliman is professor of law at University of Maryland, representing dozens of those defendants. Professor, thank you.
You're welcome.
A recent quote from former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. To put it mildly, she said, "The world is a mess." Madeleine Albright also said there are an awful lot of things going on that need understanding and explanation. Well, Madeleine Albright seemed to be channeling the frustrations of a lot of people confused about the level of mayhem and conflict running rampant this summer. And we're going to attempt something by way of understanding and explanation now, turning our attention back to a part of the world that's both under attack for invading Ukraine and supporting separatists who shot down flight MH17, killing almost 300 innocent passengers. Russia has been losing friends fast. And as you're about to hear, that might not be such a good thing. President Vladimir Putin remains hugely popular within Russia, but the country's economy is struggling as it deals with the burden of sanctions imposed by the West. Bridget Kendall has been reporting on the country for decades. She's the BBC's diplomatic correspondent. And earlier she told me there seems to be no turning back from the path Vladimir Putin is taking.
I suppose, broadly speaking, it feels as though it's inexorably moving towards worse and worse relations between Russia and the West. And everyone's been saying this isn't a new Cold War. But it seems to me that up till now, President Putin has maybe calculated perhaps he could divide Europe off from the United States. And it's been very noticeable in the last few months how strong the propaganda in Moscow has been against the Americans, not against the Europeans, the Americans. But I think where we are now with these new sanctions from the West, which is both European and American, quite tough sanctions, and the response from President Putin, which is aimed just as much at the Europeans, probably more at the Europeans than the Americans, maybe he's reaching the conclusion that he has to treat them all as one thing and that this is a growing conflict between Russia and the West, not just Russia and the United States.
And well, back on Vladimir Putin then, these latest rounds of retaliations, restricting imports from the European Union and the U.S., Bridget Kendall, are these designed really to hurt the West? Does it hurt business interests significantly in Western Europe and the United States? Or is this designed for Vladimir Putin's domestic political considerations to show that he's standing up to the United States and Germany and France and Britain and being tough?
Well, I think more the latter than the former, probably. He is under pressure at home. There's a nationalist part of those of his supporters who are saying, why haven't you invaded Ukraine yet? You know, why are you letting these poor Russian speakers in the East be obliterated by this fascist government in Kiev? That's their rhetoric. And there are indeed people in Moscow who actually embrace the idea of sanctions. They think it's a good idea to have this confrontation with the West and with NATO so that Russia breaks away from the West, so it's less under its influence, under its orders, and can reassert itself and seek new friends or reforge old alliances elsewhere in the world. So they will be rubbing their hands at these new sanctions. There's no doubt about that. But I think it's also true that Mr. Putin is probably sending a bit of a signal to the West. It's been really interesting in the last few months that since the whole question of sanctions from the West began, the message from Moscow, from the president and the prime minister, the government, has been, well, we're not going to retaliate, which seemed really strange if you think that the posture of going into Crimea was just to show how tough Russia would be and they wouldn't be messed around. Why take sanctions lying down? Well, now he's got to the point where he's not taking them lying down, and I think this is a shot across the bows. It's a message to say, well, okay, this is just foodstuffs. It doesn't hurt that much. But we could do much worse. There have been rumours that Russia might decide to close its airspace to those countries who have been party to sanctions, which would have a devastating effect on European airliners trying to fly to Asia who normally use Russia's airspace. So, you know, he could go a lot further than this.
We have a habit, Bridget Kendall, I know, at least in the United States and maybe in Britain as well, of casting Vladimir Putin as a true puppet master, his finger on every single string in Russia, calling all the shots, if I can mix metaphors there. Do the latest developments in the domestic pressures that you're describing sort of describe a Vladimir Putin who's, yes, in control, but maybe less in absolutist control than we like to portray him?
He's an authoritarian leader. I think he would probably admit that that is true, although Russia is to some extent still a democracy, and elections matter, and public opinion matters too, and different constituencies in government matter. So to some extent, he's like any other president, who always has to look at the different lobbying groups and interest groups that he has to keep happy in order to keep his position in power secure. But he's juggling lots of constituencies. And I think he is also looking to the West. And all along throughout his presidency, one of the things that he's always said, and I would say, if I were tomorrow to go to the Kremlin and talk to Mr. Putin myself, I'm fairly sure what he would say to me is, what I've always said to them is, they've just got to treat me with respect and listen to me and take my interests into account. It's not that I want a war with them or with NATO or over Ukraine. I simply have reached the end of my tether because they always ignore me and do what they want to do. And I think there's a degree to which that is still the case. And I expect that's what Angela Merkel, who's been on the phone dozens of times to Mr. Putin in the last year, he's probably been saying in these large gatherings where they've discussed sanctions that there probably is a place where you could get Mr. Putin where he might be prepared to collaborate if you don't box him into that corner. But the problem is, the longer this crisis goes on, the smaller the chink it becomes and the harder it is to see a way where you can persuade Mr. Putin to turn his back on all these nationalists who are now baying for blood and agree to some kind of compromise, which he's afraid at home might make it look as though he's agreed to some big concession.
Well, Bridget Kendall, even in these times of conflict, there's no doubt that the relationship between the United States and Russia is extremely interconnected and complicated. They've helped us on nuclear talks with Iran. They helped us with chemical weapons in Syria. But as the U.S. begins to intervene against ISIS in Iraq, is there a risk that U.S. action back in Iraq could actually have an effect in Ukraine?
Well, I'd have thought Mr. Putin sitting in the Kremlin on the one hand would probably applaud an American president going after Islamic radicals. That's always been something that he's been very focused on because of the problems that he has had in Chechnya. This sense of international instability and disarray, I think, does make the situation in Ukraine more dangerous. And it is worrying, I think, that he might think that the United States is distracted elsewhere by so many things that possibly this is a good moment to push his advantage in Ukraine.
Bridget Kendall, BBC diplomatic correspondent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we hope here at The Takeaway that you're not working too hard during August. Maybe a little bit of vacation, a bit of relaxation. But we're putting together a special Labor Day program for after this month that celebrates the hardest working Americans. And we want to hear from you. To nominate the hardest working person you know, go to our website at thetakeaway.org. Chelsea nominated her mom. She said, "My mother, a physician, is easily the hardest working person that I know. For 28 years, she's committed her life to serving communities in rural Mississippi. She's committed to childhood asthma projects, as well as issues like diabetes and obesity, two things that have plagued her area of Mississippi in the last 20 years. Many days, my mom works 15 to 18 hours at various clinics, and she does it all with such grace and love and care for her patients, to the point where many folks cry when they turn 18 because they want to keep her as their pediatrician. You can nominate the hardest working American that you know for our project right at thetakeaway.org. There you can also listen back to the show and comment on anything that we've been covering. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry will be back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.